Hey.
Yes.
Guess what I've been doing lately?
I don't know.
Mostly, actually, watching 30 Rock.
Oh, good decision.
Because I've had a bit of a rough old time, as we know. And just thank you to all the chatters for all your lovely messages about my dad dying and all that kind of stuff recently. I have found that a couple of times in my life, it's hard to concentrate or focus on things. And what I tend to turn to at those times are things that are already familiar and that don't really require anything from me. And so
slump reading.
Slump reading, exactly. So 30 Rock for me, I remember this happened to me years and years ago when I moved to Washington and I was very, very homesick and I had underestimated how homesick I would be and how much I'd miss my friends. And what I used to watch on TV when I got home from work was Friends.
Really? Oh, that's actually tragic.
I know, it's really tragic.
On about 10 different levels.
And I didn't even particularly like Friends as a show when it was on, you know, when it first started. Like, I think it's a sort of pretty middling show. But for some reason, it was the only thing that I found sort of comforting because it was so familiar, because you just knew what you were getting. It didn't really require any effort to watch. It could just wash over you. And so it was just so easy. And so 30 Rock, because it's not like the characters develop. You don't have to keep track of the plot. You could dip in and out of any episode at any time. And pound for pound, the funny lines just
– yeah.
Oh, my God. It's so brilliant and hilarious. And all of the characters I individually love in all of their own little ways. And so, yeah, it's made me feel like if I ever see Tina Fey, I just want to say to her, you know what, you got me through a really, really bad period.
I love that show.
It's great.
And if I'm ever on an aircraft and I've got like half an hour, I will always, if they've got it on the thing, I'll always go and look it up. And I just remember absolutely consuming it when it first came out. Like any new series was just like an incredibly happy, happy day.
It's just, I mean, as you know, I love Veep, as you do too. And that also just has line after line where you're just howling with laughter. But 30 Rock, I mean, I laughed aloud a lot during Veep. But 30 Rock, I mean, I probably laugh aloud 8 to 10 times per episode. And the episodes are only 22 minutes. And then other times I'm like, you know, snickering or smiling or thinking that's funny. But to laugh aloud that often, you know, it's really something else.
It does absurd and clever so well.
Oh, brilliant. And, I mean, Alec Baldwin I just think is beyond brilliant. I'm not saying anything insightful there. But I also love Jack McBrayer.
Every day I just hope and pray that he doesn't get Me Too'd. I reckon if he gets Me Too'd, really?
Don't you reckon Alec Baldwin would be the type that would,
I'm really delicately trying to not say that out loud just because I don't think we have any
coverage.
Well, I mean, he certainly.
Not. I love him.
It's mainly just because of the. God, remember that? Do you remember that 30
call.
Rock?
Oh, no.
Do you remember that 30 Rock where he's dating Condoleezza Rice? And he's constantly taking phone calls and like she's never named, but like it's clear that he keeps talking about how he's kind of dating the Secretary of State.
Oh,
like,
that's hilarious.
Oh my God. So funny.
Jack McBrayer I love as well, who's Kenneth. There was a great line the other day where I think the Tina Fey character said to him, you know, I've seen bigger chins on a premature baby.
What about every now and again he just has like a fit where he brays like a donkey?
Oh, that actor is just hilarious. But, you know, they're all sort of – all of them are just so bloody fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, so I've been watching that a lot. Do you have any comfort sort of viewing or reading habits?
I read Jeffrey Steingarten's food essays sometimes and they're so funny and – kooky and informative. He's got two collections, one called It Must Have Been Something I Ate and one called The Man Who Ate Everything.
Right.
I like reading true crime when I'm really down.
Yeah.
It's terrible really because it's never cheering.
No, but it just drives
others is worse than mine.
No, but it carries you along. Like it just drives you forwards.
Yeah.
Do you know something I've found really odd? So we were talking last time about the Melbourne Writers Festival, which I did a thing at this year. I went into the green room before my event and this woman said, "Oh, excuse me, hello, I'm Kate Kennedy." And I said, "Kate Kennedy, who's a well-known and very good writer. She wrote this book a few years back called The World Beneath, which won lots of prizes and which I absolutely loved."
She's Kate with a C.
Kate with a C. Anyway, she said to me, "Oh, I'm about to actually come to the event that you're doing and I was hoping I'd bump into you because I bought a book brought a book of my poetry to give you.
Which is like basically, what was your face looking like at this moment?
Oh, thank you so much.
I reckon that'd be a bit like, hi, hey Lee, I just made this tuna and caper salad for you.
It was a little bit like that.
I'll tell you where to put it.
But because I'm a fan of her, you know, I like her short stories that I see in the monthly and stuff, okay. I thought, okay, all right, I'll give it a go. Anyway, just to completely contradict what I just said about I can't focus on anything and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I get Kate Kennedy's book of poetry, which is called The Taste of River Water, and I thought, I'll dip into that. Anyway, I'm absolutely loving it to the degree that made me think, am I just reading – have I been reading the wrong kind of poetry all my life? Can I read one to you?
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
I'm enthralled.
It's not super long, but I thought it was just absolutely fantastic. And it just made me think just differently about poetry. Anyway, it's called Joy Flight. My father's stories must be provoked from him by some landslide of sorrow, a lost city's foundations revealed by shifting earth. Only after the death of two brothers does he relate some childhood moment of a Sunday after Mass when a tiger moth touched down on a patch of ground offering joy flights. I see them, those three blonde boys taut with longing, that silver machine, the sky. My father remembers the sum of money required for the three boys to go up and his own father's face, closed and abashed, after he asked the pilot. He turned away and my father steeled himself for the walk home to lunch. Yet somehow his father was carrying the money, and somehow he decided. They flew. Disaster could have struck and sent my grandmother mad with grief. My grandfather would have been condemned to watch that from the ground forever. But nothing went wrong. They flew and returned safely to the earth, transformed. An awestruck moment in a poor childhood, desire made real, a stern father hiding his smile on the run home. Everyone who witnessed that event is dead now. My father handed me the story, a small, recovered legacy, glinting and bright with disuse. Now I carry those three buffeted, grinning children in their Sunday clothes, hardly able to believe their luck, astonished by joy and flight. I hold this and yearn to write fiction in the face of these deaths and losses, in the face of all that is forgotten and revealed by the stark shift of pain and surprise. I want to carry this talisman carved like a rune for my father, for my uncles, for my grandfather, and for that pilot, for that pure, torn open moment where they each slipped free of the earth. Fiction, which is the ribbon pulled from a trembling mouth, which tells its truth with such defiance that everything forgotten will blaze, every joy burnished, every recollection of unexpected flight shared and passed from hand to cupped hand, carried warm next to the skin, recited for courage.
Oh my God, that's extraordinary.
It's brilliant. And
geez, I can see why you've been cheering yourself up with these.
Don't make us journey rot. It's like so. It's just so.
The rhythm. I mean, that one is quite amazing, even though it's not a. Particularly structured poem, the pulse of it is really interesting, I reckon.
And just like the content of that was just so moving. Even, you know, there's a one that I read this morning where she talks about playing in a pool, basically in a kid's yard, in a Clark's 2'6" backyard swimming pool. And there was this bit about the dad. Every morning in the cool, he is out there netting leaves off the surface in a gesture children do not recognize yet as love.
Oh,
God. It's just, it's full of stuff like that that you just go, that is really, really good writing. So, yeah, Kate Kennedy, come on down. You've converted me to poetry.
This is actually, I feel like we should issue a press release of some kind.
It's just fantastic. So now I just feel like, I mean, I already was a Kate Kennedy fan. Now I just want to go and like suck up every single thing that she's ever written in her life. And luckily she wrote her email in here for me.
Oh, right. So she inscribed it, which is very, very clever because now you can't throw it.
Actually, do you know what? I'm loving it so much. I actually had thought to myself that I would not get
really?
Rid of it. Yep, I'm keeping
it. Wow, it's quite a slender
that's
volume.
It's a mark of
mark don't even
of huge,
have my books or your books.
Yeah, so mark of huge.
That's quite amazing.
Huge honour. Anyway, yeah, so yeah, that was really great of her to do that for me. Hey, can I just, sorry, while I'm just yapping away,
yeah,
tell you about something else? I started watching, so years ago there was a documentary called The Staircase.
Right.
Have you watched it?
I haven't, but I have been meaning to for about 15 years. Like my friend Heather went on and on and on and on when I lived in London about, oh my God, you've got to watch this. It's so incredible. And I read a few references to it. I think maybe Serial or when these sort of true crime podcasts started to become or the Making a Murderer. I don't know. One of the things that we were talking about a year or two ago, there were lots of references to The Staircase and it made me think, again, I must watch that and I still haven't. And now you have. What made you?
I watched it years ago, right. But it's just, it's so far up your bracket, I can't even tell you. Because
my bracket's free at the moment, comparatively. It's an unjammed bracket, so.
We'll slide this in there.
Yeah, well, thank you.
So it is, the reason it's right up your bracket is because it's what you like, which is a real life thing where someone does a fly on the wall thing and then things go just horribly pear-shaped. Yeah, and also because you like legal stuff, you're gonna just go just spare. I like with the Americans, when I finally convinced you to watch it, I envy you knowing what's ahead watching The Staircase. So I'm not going to give any spoilers. I'll just give the premise, which is there's this guy, Michael Peterson. His wife, Kathleen, is found dead at the bottom of a staircase with a lot of head injuries, and Michael Peterson is charged with her murder.
Right.
Now, it's one of those weird cases where there's some evidence that you just think there's just no way, but then there are some amazing twists that come to light, evidence and various things that emerge. And you just watch the whole, again, I'm not, you know, spoiling anything. Everyone who's seen The Staircase, the thing you say to other people who've watched it is, do you think Michael Peterson did it?
Right, okay.
It's very hard. And Michael Peterson is a very unusual sort of character. He's an odd guy who has some characteristics that really rub me the wrong way. But then he also, his children adore him and that they're sort of, you know, except for one, they're all on his side. And anyway, it's fascinating. So the original The Staircase, which I think was maybe 6 or 8 episodes, it was the filmmakers were given absolute 100% fly on the wall access to the defense team. So they're in all of the defense strategy meetings and they get, you know, a lot of Michael Peterson talking to camera, blah, blah, blah. At the end of that is the end of the first trial. And then without spoiling it, they've now done some additional episodes because there's further developments in the story.
Oh, right. Okay.
Anyway, and it's done just as well. And even though a lot of time's elapsed, a lot of players.
So do I need to watch the first one first? And
then massive. Yeah, 100%. You have to. Right, okay. And it's all on Netflix now.
Right, okay.
So, he just started episode one, which would have been made in 2011 or whatever it was. So it is just the most riveting. And it's just one of those happy convergences where all of the talent's amazing, the story's fascinating, the film crew happened to be there, and it is, you just can't stop thinking about it and watching it when you get into it.
God.
And the twists,
all right, now
the twists are just some of the most brilliant twists ever. So you gotta watch it.
It's annoying because I just started watching a new documentary series.
Oh, okay.
But now I kind of feel like I want to jump horses.
Well, what's the new one and are you going to stick with it?
The one that I've started watching is called Wild, Wild Country.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a documentary about a cult, like a charismatic cult, a group that moves into this town in Oregon, like in the mountains. And they all wear orange and basically, it's the story of how the locals respond to this completely unusual group of arrivals. But I can't even tell you how, like, the main thing at the beginning that you notice about this documentary is that it is such an incredible piece of filmmaking visually.
Oh, okay.
It is beautiful. It's just actually pleasurable to watch because of the care that's gone into the way that they've framed the interviews. It's like a love letter to cinematography. It is. It's really striking.
Mm.
And so seriously, like, Jeremy put it on, and within 2 minutes, I was like leaning forward out of my chair to get close to the screen. Wow. It was just like, it's extraordinary.
Was this the thing that Rabe talked about?
Rabe! Did Rabe talk about it? I can't remember. I can't remember a single thing that she said. All I can remember is the violence of my love.
But is the visuals matched by the content? Like, is it holding your interest?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
Oh, we'll finish it off then. I mean, the staircase will still be sitting.
I know. Well, I've not watched it for 15 years or whatever. So
the other thing I've been watching, which is on ABC iView, is a show called The Split, which is a BBC show.
Right.
Or is it Channel 4? Can't remember. My friends in London were just like, you've got to watch this. It's brilliant, blah, blah, blah. It's a drama. It is sort of a family drama, I guess. It's a mother and three daughters. One of the daughters is the main character. They all work in family law, doing marriage breakups and property settlements and stuff like that. I'm enjoying it. I'm definitely going to keep watching it. I don't love it as much as my friends.
And what's the story?
It's sort of the mother's raised the three daughters on her own, and then the father shows up out of the blue after 30 years of having been absent. It's sort of their personal lives, but also the cases that they're working on in the law firm. I'm liking it, not loving it as much as my friends in London raved about it, but I'm certainly going to keep watching it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just going straight to the staircase anyway.
Yeah, I know. Everything I say to you is a moot point now. Hey, what's that book you've been reading about Nabokov?
Oh.
Or as you insist on calling him, Nabokov.
Nabokov. Vladimir Nabokov. Okay, so it's this book. It's a novel, but it's modelled on Nabokov and his wife. See, I've just thrown you a bone there, love. The relationship between Vladimir and
Vera.
His wife, Vera. And it's kind of, it's a novel that kind of gallops along. It's quite readable. It's beautifully written. And the storyline is about this young woman who is evacuated to America from Russia as a child. And she's sent to this fancy girls' school, and she sort of struggles a bit there to make friends. And she's eventually taken on by the school as a to look after the gardens. And then this teacher arrives, this Russian emigre, and his incredibly beautiful wife, with whom he has a very complex, deep and emotional relationship. And they sort of develop a bit of a love triangle arrangement. And now I do not know all that much about the amatory adventures of the real Nabokov, but it's and I don't know to what extent it's really derived from fact, but the portrait of the marriage is quite compelling. Yeah.
Would you recommend it?
I wouldn't rave about it, but I found it one of the most interesting things that I found about it is that it's very Russian, you know. But the woman who wrote it isn't Russian. She's done this huge amount of research, and she wants to infuse into the novel this Russian sensibility. And I was really surprised when I went and sort of looked her up. Her name is Adrienne Kelt. Not Drusky. It's quite an achievement, I think, this book. But it didn't set me aflame or anything, but I did sort of march through it. I found it gripping and I didn't ever sort of yawn. It was and as I say, beautifully written.
They should pull that for a cover blurb. No, I didn't ever yawn.
I know,
Annabelle
Crabb. That's exactly what
three
I was
stars.
Thinking. Oh my god, that's a shocker, isn't it? I tell you what, I did that actually. Grabbed me and just held my attention in an oh my god way throughout that I read recently is a book called Dope Sick.
Yeah.
There was an extract of it somewhere in a magazine or something, and it was one of those things where I read the extract and I went straight and bought the book straight away.
Mm.
So this book is about It's about the opioid crisis in America, and it just basically looks at the Shenandoah Valley and looks at the growth in opiate use and abuse in this quite small area. And it's absolutely mind-blowing. Like, it follows it's written so beautifully by a local journalist, basically, who's just been following this story. So you get quite attached to her. She's such a perceptive person, and the way that she, like, there's a bunch of dope addicts that she kind of follows, and her attention is almost, it's not really motherly, it's just incredibly close attention. You can tell that she's completely invested in these people's lives, and when they have triumphs or they beat something, then she's kind of right there, and then when they relapse, she's there too.
So there's first person in it.
Yeah.
Right.
And she describes her interactions with the parents of kids who have overdosed, and basically the story is that this drug company, Purdue Pharma, started really pushing OxyContin onto doctors and they had arrangements with doctors where they'd whisk them off for holidays and give them sort of prescribing targets and really talk up the importance of treating pain, and pain is like an epidemic that's untreated in America. But it also folds in with the closure of the coal mines in that area and this sort of generation of people who haven't ever had work. And after a while, just being prescribed and then selling excess OxyContin becomes like the craft industry of the area. Mm. So like there's young people who are kind of trading Oxys, and then there's older people who are getting them prescribed and then selling them to pay their power bills. You know, it's the most just devastating socioeconomic crisis. It's not just about addiction. It's about people's lack of anything else to base their life on or even derive an income from. It's just horrifying, this story, right? And so she also follows some lawyers who are trying to sue the pharmaceutical company. And then she also follows some heroin dealers, because what happens is that the OxyContin becomes actually more expensive than heroin to buy. And so people who are addicted to the opiate go for the next cheapest thing, which is heroin. And oh my God. Anyway, it is the most shocking book, but it's also full of just really heroic characters as well. Like, there's this one doctor who just runs this one-man campaign, and there's a great nun as well, and just these people who are trying to pitch themselves against this advancing crisis. It's an amazing book. It really is.
It's actually, do you know what, as you've been describing it, it made me think of a Stephen King novel.
Yep.
Like, that's what it sounds like.
It's like It or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's
just this, or what's the one with the plague that goes through? Can't remember.
It's just, wow. And like some of the stories of these kids who have died as well, because like I think they've got amazing figures, like, you know, 300,000 people died, up to 2009 or something, and they think that that will double, you know. It's just this advancing.
Did you say 300,000?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's like, it's a huge.
And then you look at mortality. Like, say, 9/11.
Yeah.
And then the amount of the billions, if not trillions, of dollars that have been spent to try to avoid future deaths from terrorism versus that, my God, that is unbelievable.
Yeah. And it goes into a lot of detail about the way America treats drug addiction or opioid addiction. There's a really low take-up of what they call MAT, which is medically assisted treatment, which is where you take a different kind of drug to get you off that drug. And hardly any of the drug courts send people down that road. Like, there's just detention, like imprisonment is really, option number one for people who have drug-related offences. And
I read a story for The Monthly a few years ago now about the drug court at Parramatta.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was Judge Roger Dive, who I think is still there actually, presided over it. I found it really interesting, and that is considered, you know, it's got bipartisan support. It's considered, you know, a really good success. It was really interesting to watch it because people would come in and, you know, obviously prison was considered the last resort. You were basically told if we test you or if you go off the rails, you are going to prison. And I saw people when I was there, they would come in and they'd give every excuse about, oh, this and that. No, I forgot to blah, blah, blah. I slept in, dog ate my homework. And in a very kindly way, the judge would just go, okay, sorry, hand in your wallet, you know, blah, 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 take off your jewelry, whatever it was, and off they'd go. They'd be escorted, you know, downstairs. But then Roger Dive had this thing where if people came in and they'd sort of met their targets, he would ask the courtroom to give them a round of applause.
Yeah, right.
And it was really – I talked to him in his chambers afterwards about it, and because on paper it sort of seems a bit naff, but actually when you saw the reaction to people when they got a round of applause, and he said, you know, for most of these people, they will have not been praised like that or never had a round of applause in their life for doing anything. So he said he was just trying very hard to sort of be – you know, compassionate but also firm.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to sort of watch it, you know, that you were given this chance, but if you stuffed it up, then that was that, you know. So anyway, it was very interesting. I got to go, Toots.
Yeah, I
got to
go too.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Get out of my office.
Oh, actually, can I do one thing?
Melbourne.
Yes. Yeah? Jeremy said, just to remind everyone that we have a live show in Melbourne coming up in November. I think it's the 15th. If you go to the Ticketek website and search for Chat 10 Looks 3, you'll find it. We've got no idea what we're going to be doing there. We'll probably work it out on that afternoon at 3 p.m.
Probably, yeah. Thank you for remembering to mention that because there are still some seats left, I think.
There are still some seats left for that. We are going to have a show in Canberra in December, but we haven't got the tickets on sale yet, but we'll keep you posted on that. Have we got anything else? My new book arrived this week. Oh, I got the actual hard copy of it, Any Ordinary Day, in my hot little hands.
That's a great book.
Yeah, we're doing a thing in Sydney together, actually, talking about that at Seymour Centre on the 2nd of October. There are tickets available for that. Just Google Lee Sales Annabelle Crabb, Any Ordinary Day. But come along to Melbourne because that should be – that. Those shows in Melbourne last year were super fun.
Yeah, they
Melbourne
were.
Audiences were great. Chris from Breakthrough has sadly moved back to Ireland now, so
probably because
he won't be able to do
a
number with me.
Humiliation that you visited upon him. Okay. Nice one.
See ya.
See ya.